Episode number 211 with Carlos Welch. Welcome to the Heads Up Poker Podcast. This is Steve Barton.
This is Carlos Welch.
And let's see, the last time we left off, Mikey and I were out at the WSOP. I've since returned home, so has Mike. And Carlos, you're still there. How's your summer going?
Today is July 3rd, which is my mom's birthday.
Oh.
And I'm really happy because it means I only have one or two more days in this godforsaken town.
Oh, last time we talked, you were so optimistic. I guess Vegas has taken its toll, huh?
I'm so over it. So over it. And you know what? This is the title of your episode right here. We tried to record earlier, and I put in my name. Mm-hmm. And you read it incorrectly.
Oh.
Carloths Live. Loathes.
Not Carlo at the Live.
So I've gone from Carlos to Carlos to Carlooser to Car Lockdown to at the beginning of the summer, Carlos Vegas to now Carloths Live. I hate live tournaments. I may never play another one for the rest of my life.
Well, I would bet the other side of that, my friend. But oh man, it. What have you had any good runs? You got a satellite, right? You hit a satellite.
So today was the last tournament on my package, and so I stayed up late last night railing my buddy. And I'm satellite to the main, and basically, like, you know, coaching him up over the DMs and like looking around for short stacks, doing my poker caddy thing.
Yeah.
And he ended up getting a seat.
Nice.
And so I was up till about 2:30 helping him with that. And then this morning I went to play the 9 a.m. mega. Actually, it was like 3:30. So I only got like maybe 4 or 5 hours of sleep and got up to play the 9 a.m. mega. And when I left the room, like 8:30 to play. And at 9:30, I was on my way back to the room as he was leaving. And he was like, what the hell? Their first hand I played, jacks against tens, all in pre-flop for 35 bigs. And then I lost that. And then I just lost in some standard push fold spots from there, but that ended up putting me at 1 for 16 on this trip.
Oh.
And so the one, luckily for me, the one was the Survivor. It was the biggest tournament I played, which is the Survivor at Planet Hollywood. $1,100 buy-in. If you cash, you get $10,000. Mm-hmm. But I got $4,000 because we chopped when my stack was worth $4,000.
Okay.
And so, yeah, that was basically the only score I had this summer. So if I'm going to play live again in the future, it's going to be satellites and survivors. I'm so done with tournaments.
I ended up rounding it out with, well, you bought 5%. So, you know, anyone that invested 5%, paid 290 and got 240 back. So it was, could have been worse. It was tough because I got in some great spots where I was a huge favorite and then just the guy got lucky. It's like, what can you do? You know, online, I'd had four tournaments going at the same time. Yeah. Wouldn't even think about it. Just open another one. But live, it's like, it's such a commitment and the buy-ins, fucking $1,500, you know, just like one. This one in particular, it was in the bounty tournament, $1,500 buy-in, $500 for each bounty. There was a guy that was pretty loose, and he was a pro. He opened under the gun, min-raised, and at an eight-handed table, I was in the, let's see, I was on the button with queens. I three bet. He calls. The flop comes 2-6-6. So when he called my three bet, I can put him on things like ace queen plus, probably all pairs. That's about it. So after this flop, I'm losing to quads. I'm losing to sixes. I'm losing to deuces. If he calls there with deuces, I think he might. So he checks. I see bet about half the pot. He calls.
You generally use a pretty big size and on three bets too, right?
I do. Yeah, I went. He min raised. I don't remember what the blind levels were, but I popped it to 3.2 to 3.3 times what his original open was. So I three bet to a little over 6x, and then he calls. And so the flop was 2-6-6. The turn was a 7. So now we're losing to sevens, but we're crushing everything else. I don't know if he's calling there with ace king on that flop, so I think we can almost take that out of his range, because my hand kind of looks like what it is, I think, like a big pair.
What size did you make it on the flop percentage wise?
Half pot.
Yeah, that may get some people to fold ace king. I know if you go smaller for sure, they'll call once and then fold on the turn.
Yeah,
but maybe half pot is enough to get them off, especially in a three bet pot.
Yeah. I set it up to where the amount that I bet, it wasn't so much for me, the percentage of the pot I was betting. I was setting up a turn shove, so it would put me all in. And he calls. So at that point, I think he still has pairs. I think I can pretty much take aces and kings out of his range because he didn't four bet me. So I think he has my hand queens, jacks, tens, nines, eights, sevens, sixes. And I would think that he's folding pairs below a six, probably on the flop or definitely by the, I would think, yeah. Anyways, the turn was a 7. He checks. I push all in for a pot size bet. It was about 10K. There was about 10 in the pot. And he thinks a long time. And that's where I'm like, oh God, he has nines. This is perfect, you know? And there's something too about the bounty tournament. Like, I think it's more powerful there to move all in on the turn because of the fact that he's got the $500 bounty there than it is to just make a small little valuey bet, you know?
Yep.
And so he hems and haws and finally he counts out a call and he flips over 10-10. And I'm like, oh, thank God. And the dealer, she had this way of like grabbing and flipping the card to where the card would flash. I was in the number one seat, so I'm directly to the dealer's left. And when she grabbed the card, I could see instantly that it had four diamonds on one side, but I couldn't tell which card it was. And I was thought, oh shit, I just went from 96% to 50-50, because that's one of two cards. It's either the nine of diamonds or it's the 10 of diamonds. The 10 I lose and the 9 I win. And it cannot be the 8 of diamonds because the 8 of diamonds has 3 diamonds on one side and then 2 in the middle. So she lays the card down on the table and she holds her hand over it. She had this habit of doing that like it was a goddamn magic trick or something. And she was building the suspense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She finally moves her hand and it's the 10 of diamonds. And I'm like, shit. Are you kidding me?
I had a deal.
$100 with 96% and just out.
Yeah, man. I had a dealer that would do that also. It was driving me crazy. Like, I want to say he took, like, probably, like, 30 seconds every time he shuffled, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a long-ass time.
Yeah.
And then when he spread the flop, he would do it, like, one card at a time. Like, he would have all the cards under his palm, and he would, like, slap his palm down on the table and, like, slowly revealed it. You know, three, like you
would just squeeze it out. Just
you would see the third card probably like 10 seconds after you saw the first card.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Every single flop.
Oh,
I could not stand that tape. That's another reason I don't like that. Never happens to me on Bovada.
So the that's dealers enough. Don't slow roll you on there. Huh?
Oh no, they don't slow roll you on there. So that's another reason I'm over live.
Yeah.
But the main reason, to be honest with you, is looking around at guys like you, Mike, Andrew, and now at this point, I saw this on Twitter today, even Negreanu. Like, there's so many people who I personally know or I've seen that actually have success in tournaments. Like, they've made deep runs. But the way these tournaments are structured nowadays, a deep run does nothing. Like, you have to final table.
Yeah.
Like I want to say Andrew played the Colossus. I don't know. No, it was the 888. I'm not sure how many entrants it had. I can look it up. But he got, like, really deep. I want to say, like, he maybe went out, like, 50th or 30th or something. And I think he got, like, maybe 10 buy-ins. And and if you think about the number of people we had to get through to get that, it's pretty bad.
And it's probably got to be like 6,000 or something.
Yeah, yeah. And Mike had a really deep run in a tournament and got like maybe 7 buy-ins, I think.
Yeah.
And your deep run, what was your
I made the top. Let's see, there were 6,200 runners. I got 309, so top 4%, 5%, something like that, and I got 3 buy-ins.
Yeah, yeah. So it's almost like these big field tournaments, and we had this discussion on Twitter recently when I was talking about how Ryan LaPlante, who's my coach, taught me about it, how it's so much more important to cash in these big field tournaments. And then so you, on the one hand, you have to cash because that's going to be like the most likely outcome anyway, is yeah. Like a min cash or just above it. So that's almost like your initial target. But then from there, you pretty much have to final table it to get any type of decent number of buy-ins. But those two goals seem conflicting because sometimes in order to guarantee that you can cash, you end up like folding down into the money. And if you do that, it's harder to win. And to get the big stack in order to win, sometimes you have to like take chances around the bubble or before that can often result in you not cashing. So it's like, yeah, two sides of the same coin. And it's like, there's really no middle ground. And I almost feel like if you're not getting into the top 99.9% of fields on a regular basis, then these live tournaments just aren't even worth it. Because top 1% doesn't cut it anymore.
Yeah.
That's like getting your money back.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, it was tough to play for 3 days like that. And then, I mean, it was good to score a cash because it just felt good to get some money coming back in. But it was, it was like 3 days worth of play. And I get 3 buy-ins.
And the recreational players love these new smaller buy-in multi-day tournaments so much that they're willing to like wait in these massive lines for it. And people will complain, but they don't get out of line. And so the WSOP is just making money hand over fist this way. So I can expect more of this in the future. In fact, I can see the buyers dropping even further because that's going to open it up to even more recreational players. And WSOP also gets to rake each buy-in a bigger percentage as the buy-in drops. So this is like what we saw this year is going to seem like heaven compared to what I expect it to be over the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, they flatten the payout structure too.
Yeah.
You know? And so when you do cash, it's not as significant.
Yeah, like Alex Fitzgerald used to say, like, PokerStars started doing that and said they'll just give you enough money to, like, rebuy so you can get raked again. that's basically what it is, and I'm just not going to participate. So I'm pretty much done with big field live tournaments for sure. I'll probably still play like some smaller dailies or maybe 100, maybe 200 player fields, and I'll always play survivors or multi-table or like the mega satellites. Like, those are kind of immune for this. And at this point, the only WSOP event I'm interested in is the 1500 shootout. Because that one, you win 2 tables and you make a final table. You don't have to go through all this variance. I mean, it's tough. Like, those are some pretty tough fields, and you have to, you know, win heads-up matches to get to the final table. But to me, those fit my my purposes a lot more. Like, I used to like be excited for the online events. I don't want to play the online events no more. You can't use a HUD. Still the same problems with the massive fields and the low buy-ins or the small min caches. So like even online doesn't appeal to me anymore. Even the main, like I'm pretty like the main starts, I think either today or tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure I could like easily sell, actually get into the main. I just don't want to play it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to play the satellites to the main. And even if I win a seat, I'm just going to sell the Lammers. I'd rather take the cash and then go play on Bovada than to play in the main event.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I'm not quite there. Maybe I will be next year, but I had 4 bracelet events that I played in. Actually, no, I didn't play in one of them because I ended up making a day 2. But I do want to play the main next year. I've got one guy's already offered to buy 25% of that, so that's cool. And one thing I learned too, I am going to charge a little markup next year. That I had to put new tires on my car, get the front end alignment, all the gas, food. I'm like, you know, and then if you don't want to stand in a 2-hour line, you got to pay a 3% charge on your card to get into the tournament. And I had to put $5,000 on that card to get my free parking anyway. So it basically cost me $150 in rake to be able to get free parking. But I think I would end up spending more than $150 a year on parking at all the Caesars properties. But yeah, I need to charge a little markup next time. And it's so much easier if you have fewer investors.
Yes.
You know, when it comes to all the paperwork and paying guys out and collecting and all that. So yeah, lessons learned. It was a blast. It was so much fun. But I was just adding up my totals for the summer, and I put in almost 90 hours and lost $210. So it could be worse, but it was kind of frustrating to play for so long.
The way you have to look at it is if you're the type of person who enjoys playing tournaments for the sake of playing tournaments, it's perfect for you. But you can't really look at it, in my opinion, as like a job. Or actually, I mean, I guess you can. I don't even know how to put what I'm trying to say. Like, you can't go in there expecting to win, as crazy as that sounds. Mm-hmm. It's almost like you have to enjoy the process of trying to win, knowing that, you know, 99 times out of 100, you're going to walk away, you know, break even at best.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty tough. And I think almost regardless of who you are, that's going to be the case with the big fields. And the thing I was mentioning about Negreanu, Norman Chad had a tweet earlier today where he talked about Negreanu has cashed in 28% of the tournaments that he's played this year. Mm-hmm. And with 3 WSOP final tables, and he's still down money.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm looking at that tweet right now.
Yeah. So I'm thinking like,
all cash is at high rate, 28% with 3 final tables and still losing.
Yeah.
Wow.
You have to win these things, man, or at least final table.
Yeah.
It's like if you're getting like, if you get 27th and like, you know, 30% of tournaments that you play, you may still be a losing to break even player, especially like you said, when you factor in all the live rake.
Yeah. 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 It was a fun summer, but it was good to see a lot of the guys. I ran into Corey Wildland. I ran into Andrew Broca several times. Andrew, he was funny. I was coming out. We were both playing the double stack or the deep stack, whatever the 1K one was. Uh-huh. And I come out on break, and I'm like, oh, hey, Andrew, how's it going? We've been playing for maybe 8 hours or something like that. It was day 2. And I see Andrew in the hallway. I'm all, hey, Andrew, what's up? And he's oh, hey. And I said, are you still in the 1K? And he's all, no, actually, I busted the 1K, and I've busted 2 other tournaments since that tournament. So, as always, Steve, great to see you. And then he walks off.
Yeah. Yeah. I think up until this last deep run, he's had kind of a rough summer also.
Has he?
But when I look at his results, he's had some catches, but they're mostly like, you know, men catches. Even like the idea, like even when you go deep, you men catch. Like that blows my mind.
Yeah.
Like there's tournaments where you make, like you beat 95% of the field, and that could be thousands of players, and you still more or less men cash. Yeah. Like in my mind, anything less than like 5 buy-ins is a men cash.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's exactly what I did. I made the top 4%. And I had 3 buy-ins. That's it.
Yeah.
Why not just cut it off at 10%? Start paying.
That's what they used to do. That's what they used to do, and I think that was kind of like the heyday of professional tournament players. Yeah. And now they're spreading out to the point where that's starting to become less of a possibility unless you are able to get in a lot of volume, which is just almost impossible live.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a huge commitment. I mean, you got to pack your food, get a good night's sleep, drive your candy ass all the way down to the hotel, play for 2 hours, have a 15-minute break, 2 hours, 15-minute break, just day after day after day. It's and still all the while trying to, at least I'm trying to get in some kind of exercise each day so I don't slowly wither away into a turd. And yeah. It's long and grueling.
I think what you have to do is like some of these guys who are firing max bullets into these tournaments, because in one way that helps you get your volume up, because each bullet is kind of like a different buy-in.
Yeah.
But also you need to have a pretty good short stack game if you're going to, you know, decrease your average starting stack size by doing that. And B, you just need to be willing to like fire multiple tournaments when you, like if you bust a tournament, like Andrew, for example. It's like you bust a tournament, you got to be willing to fire 2 or 3 more before you go home. And I don't have that kind of heart. Like if I played all day and I bubble something, the last thing I want to do is play something else from level one.
Yeah. 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 So, yeah,
you got to be a true grinder to do this live tournament thing.
Yeah. There was one at the Golden Nugget. I was going to go play that, but it was like a 3-day event and it was a $200 buy-in. I'm all, yeah. Oh, fuck that. Are you kidding me? I can play for 3 days and make like $50 because I'm in cash or something.
In two years, that's going to be a bracelet event. I can see it. Right. With like probably 6 starting flights and like in the men cash might be like $250.
Right. Yeah.
I'm just not going to be here for that. I will be looking for more and more smaller fields and bigger buy-ins relative to the max that you can earn, because that tends to keep the field size small. So like for example, the PH Survivor that I won, that I chopped, it had 42 entrants and we chopped 7-handed, and in fact one of my students chopped it also, and this guy he had a stack that was worth about 8 buy-ins. So 42 runners, we chopped 7-handed, and he got 8 buy-ins. And then the very next day, he played the Colossus. And the Colossus had 13,000 runners. And I want to say that he finished in the top 100, and he also got 8 buy-ins for that.
Wow.
So you can either go through 13,000 people to get 8 buy-ins, or you can go through 42 people to get 8 buy-ins. And it's just like, you know, one of those things is just, you know, the variance is so ridiculous that you can't expect to, like, win on any type of consistent basis. But, you know, these 42 player fields, you can, like, crank those out kind of consistently, I think.
And what was this 42 player one? Was it a satellite or what was it?
It was a Survivor, so an $1,100 buy-in, and they guarantee 10K cash to 3 places. But because we got over 30 players, we have 42 players, so they guarantee 4 spots. So it's supposed to be 10K to 4 spots, and then fifth would have got 2K.
Yeah.
But seven-handed, they suggested that we just do a chip chop that was like roughly equivalent to what the stacks were worth at the time. And my stack was worth 4K at the time, so I took that. But my students, his stack was worth 8K, so he took it. But the funny thing about it is the guy who was one of the worst players there had the biggest stack. Like that's a kind of a oxymoron, but if you look at a Survivor or a Satellite, the player with the biggest stack is usually the worst player because this person has taken on extra risk to get more chips that aren't bringing him more cash.
Yeah.
It's not like if you're the chip leader and you bust the guy second in chips, you're not going to get like two payouts.
Yeah.
So that guy actually got the worst deal, even though he got, 10K.
Yeah.
His stack was probably worth about 20 or 25K. But yeah, those tournaments are great because the variance is super low. Nobody really understands how to play them correctly. Like we talk about all the time, these spots where you have to fold aces or kings, and people just aren't capable of doing that.
And so, they would never do it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just going to focus on that type of thing going forward. Like I said, I'm going to sell a package today for the mega satellites to the main. There's on Friday and Saturday, they do a 1K at 1 p.m. Mm-hmm. and pay seats to the top 10%. And at 8 p.m., they do a 2K. And that one pays seats to the top 20%. And by seats, I mean Lambers. So I'll just take the Lambers and then sell them.
Yeah.
But most people are like trying to get into the main and they're not good. They're not good.
Yeah. And you just sell those Lambers standing in line, right? You go to all the people standing in line and you're like, hey, I can.
Yeah. I mean, I used to do that. Now I just like sell them to people I know.
Okay.
And the good thing about this year is that there's like another 10 tournaments after the main starts. And some of them are like, there's a 50K and a 100K
wow.
tournament. And so it's not going to be hard to get off the Lammers because people are going to still be firing on WSOP tournaments.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's going to be my lane going forward. Online tournaments on Bovada. And live Survivors and Satellites, and also Sit and Goes, which are basically the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. It, yeah, the dailies are good too. I hit a daily. Yeah. I got second out of 85 people, and I mean, I was by far the best player, easily. I just did the Andrew Pieper style, it was really like shooting fish in a barrel. You just gotta have your hands hold up.
Yeah, I saw that one. That was that PH or
that was Caesars. They got I think it's a 150 buy-in, something like that. I mean, some of the rakes are a little bit higher in those, but I mean, Andrew and I were talking about it, Andrew Pieper, and it almost doesn't matter because the players are so bad. You know, it makes up for it.
Yeah, like outside of the series, when I was in Vegas, I used to play a lot of the win dailies. And they're basically the same thing, but we're actually reasonable rake.
Yeah, yeah.
As far as like live tournaments, I'll probably still play like win dailies. But like during the series, next year, if I'm going to play a live tournament, it's going to be somewhere where the field sizes don't get above like maybe 200 max.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's so fun playing final tables, and in those you have a shot.
That's the other thing. And see, and this is kind of what I meant earlier about enjoying the process. Like regging a tournament, playing level one, like getting reads is actually fun to me. So at the beginning of a tournament when I can get reads, that's fun to me. The most tilting thing to me about tournaments is developing reads and then the table breaks.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you don't have your reads and you're usually shorter at that point. So when you most desperately need reads, you don't have them. So other than the read gathering part at the beginning, the other just like process of going through a tournament isn't really fun to me unless I have a big stack and I'm crushing, which is like, pretty rare. The only thing that's fun to me is the final table. Yeah. And so I want to focus on tournaments where I get to that portion of it a lot more often. Like, there's nothing more tilting than like getting into the money and then looking up and realizing you still have to get through another 1,000 people
so true.
To final table it.
Yes.
It's almost like the first part of the tournament was like a satellite into another tournament.
It is. It is. Yeah. It is.
I don't have.
I got a question on, I came into this and I'm curious what you think about it. We did a chop at a Rio daily that I busted something, and then I thought there's literally no tournaments going on right now for the next 4 hours that are of anything. So I went and played a little $100 or $150 at the Rio. We get down to, let's see, there was $2,500 in the prize pool and we're down to five players. And then someone suggested a chop and they were all willing to take $500 each. And I'm by far the shortest stack at the table. I have 10% of the chips in play, but they're offering me 20% of the money. So I took it. But yeah. I'm wondering, like, where do you kind of draw the line there? I'm sure Andrew Pieper would say that that's good, because I watched him win a tournament where, well, he chopped three-handed and he did exactly that. They were offering him, I can't remember what it was, but if they were offering him 30% of the prize pool and he only had 20% of the chips and he didn't even think about it, he's all, yeah, I'll take it, took his money, and that was it. And he talked to me about that afterwards, and I'm like, why don't you just go for first? And he's all, they were offering me more than my chips were worth, so it's a good deal. He told me, I can't remember who the player was that wrote an article about that, but he was saying that there was a pro that was saying that if you're playing these tournaments and they ever offer you more than what your chips are worth, you should take it.
Yeah, you basically just run an ISIM calculator, and that is what you should take, given that, you know, you're equally skilled. Mm-hmm. But if you have an edge on them, then yeah, you can kind of demand a bit more than that. And yeah, anytime you can lock that up, you should. That reduces your variance.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because at the time my chip stack was worth $250, but they're offering me five, double that. It seemed like a good idea, right?
Yeah. The Saturday that I chopped, or the Survivor that I chopped, we were at 3K, 6K blinds, and I had 67K, and my stack was worth exactly 4K.
Okay.
But when the chop happened, I was under the gun, and this was a big blind anti-tournament.
Oh.
So in two hands, I would have had to put in a quarter of my stack.
Yeah.
And I definitely would have lost those chips, because it was the portion of a Saturday that other people don't understand this, but it was a portion of the Saturday where I really can't call with anything. I just have to, like, shove wide.
Yeah.
So, and I had a player at the table that was, like, raising every hand, so – he definitely would have took my big blind and the big blind ante that I put in, and also the small blind. And I'm only going to get a shove in a case where he doesn't open, and, you know, I can get an open shove and have a halfway decent hand for it. So not only did I chop for exactly what my stack was worth, I was going to lose, you know, a quarter of the value of my stack and like one or two hands. So it was like perfect timing for me, even though I felt like by far I was the best player at the table.
Yeah. Yeah. It, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. You know, I met with a guy while I was out there. He bought a piece of me, and listener of the podcast, his name's Zach, and he has an idea for an app, or maybe it's not even an app, but just like some avenue where professionals can go on. It would be something like Bravo, or Poker Atlas, you know, so you can go onto these apps and you look and you can see which tournaments are playing for the day. So it makes it very convenient. You know, before in the old days, you'd have to call around and find out or just memorize who has a tournament at what time, you know. But now with these apps, they're available to everyone. Well, he sees a weakness in these apps, and I think he's right in that, you know, the apps, they'll show you what the rake is. You know, so, and he was talking about like some of the wind tournaments, you know, they used to have 550s, and then they had, I think at one point, I could be wrong, but I think they had 535. So 500 went to the prize pool, 35 went to rake, and then it was 550. And some of these are like 500 plus like 95. I mean, it's just like, they're just raking in the rake, you know, and he wants to come up with a program that you can put in all the information, and then it basically spits out an answer as to like which ones are the most valuey, what the blind structures are. And I know you've written articles on this, and Andrew Pieper's like mastered this when it comes to dailies. But yeah, he wanted my opinion to think if I thought there was any value in that. And I'm like, I sure as hell think so. I would sign up for a service like that if it was able to spit out some kind of algorithm that would show you what, you know, how valuable is this tournament really, you know?
Yeah, I do like the idea of it, but my question would be like, how would you value things that, like for me, like rake makes sense to me. Like it's a numerical thing that's easy to understand.
Yeah.
Like structures, like some people like slower structures, some people like faster structures. So like, how do you score the structure when it's kind of like a matter of opinion, what people like about it. It's probably a way to work around that. But I like that. I like the idea overall. Cause like in my old articles, that's what I used to do. I basically just like, I categorized everything based off of, so like, for example, I did one recommendation, like if you're looking for long structures or slow structures, I recommended one thing. If you're looking for low rake, I recommend another thing. I can't remember all the categories I went through. I think starting stack was another one. Like some tournaments have like slow structures, but you start with so few chips. The other tournament starts with a lot of chips, but the structure's so fast that like in two or three levels, you're short.
Yeah, it really doesn't matter. It's just kind of smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, but like if I was going to like recommend one tournament based on all those categories, it would be kind of hard to do because people are looking for different things in tournaments.
Yeah, I put him in contact with Jacob Triba because we've had him on the show. You know Jacob, he's such a math-based guy, and he would be able to somehow put this into an algorithm, I think, or at least get somewhat close to it. And then I put him in contact with Andrew Pieper because Andrew basically does this on a daily basis with dailies. And then Doug Lyford too. I thought he might be good on like the software side of it. But I don't know. Zach was kind of, he was like, you know, how can I monetize this? How can I make money from it? And I was like, honestly, man, I would just like come up with something that's so valuable that people want it, and you'll find an avenue for making money from it somehow. You know what I mean? And eventually that'll just come in. But yeah, he's a grinder. He plays these and this year he was like, it's like they're just hiking up the rake every year, you know, just a little more, a little more, a little more. And it's like, you're right, they are.
Yeah, that, but in my experience, the Wynn is still the best place in town as far as rake, and I want to say Golden Nugget is the worst.
Yeah, like, Golden Nugget's pretty bad.
They've done some type of great PR work where people actually, you know, rave about them. Like, I want to say they got this tournament where it's like a small buy-in is like a really big guarantee and all these starting flights. And if you bag, you get like cash for each bag you do. And like people, it kind of like creates a buzz, and people who I know are really good at math and good at poker were like raving about it. And I'm thinking like, they probably like they're raking damn near like 30-35% on this thing.
Yeah.
But people don't care. They don't care.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's another reason I like the satellites and the sit and goes, because the rake is usually smaller in those, especially the sit and goes, where you can work in last longer, is that like lower the effective rake.
What do you mean? How do you just make a bet with the whole table?
Yeah. So if you play a 175 sit and go, they take out $15 from each player. Mm-hmm. So you're really gambling. You're paying $15 rake to gamble for $160. But the tables often will do last longer. Now, in the past, it used to be $20 a head. And now I saw a lot of them that were like $100 a head. So instead of doing like $15 a rake to gamble for 160, you do $15 a rake to gamble for 260, because the last longer money is not raked. So what that does is lower the effective rake from whatever 15 divided by 160 is to 15 divided by 260.
Yeah. Huh. That's it. And it's pretty common for the whole table to be in on this. I could picture a few amateurs like, oh, no, I don't.
It's pretty common. You do get some amateurs that won't do it, but that's fine. You don't need the whole table to do it. You just do it with the people who want to be involved.
Oh, I didn't even think of that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, maybe I need to get into some of these single table satellites. I played like two of them and never cashed. And then I was like, oh, I'm out. That was it.
I think they're by far the best deal in the house.
Okay. Okay. And you, I saw you mention, I know, Dara, O'Kearney, he just wrote a book specifically on these, satellites, right?
Dara wrote a book specifically on mega, multi-table, like they have different names, mega satellites, super satellites, multi-table satellites, which is basically like what you think of as in terms of a satellite to get into a bigger event, like the ones that they're running right now to get into the main. That's different from the single tables. The single table satellites just fire when there's 10 people at the table. And the satellite structure, I mean, the satellite strategy from Dara's book doesn't really apply to single table satellites.
Okay.
But just so happens that yours truly, Carlos Welch and Andrew Brokus, just put out a premium podcast product that focuses specifically on single table satellites.
Ooh.
Yeah. And so you can get that at knitcast.com. I'm sure we can get a link in the show notes, so I'll get that to you.
Okay, yeah. Throw me a link and I'll throw it in the show notes.
Yeah, it's like 4 hours of Andrew and I discussing single table satellite strategy, common mistakes that most people make, and also we play hands against Poker Snowy to kind of like simulate a single table satellite.
Okay.
To get like hand examples to discuss in the podcast. So far the feedback has been really positive on it. I've had old students that had some great results in the single tables this year, and also I've picked up some new students from it, and so far most people definitely have found value in it.
Good Cool. All right, yeah, I look forward to listening to it. We'll throw a link in the show notes, and if you guys want it, click on it and pick it up. That's cool.
Yep.
Do you have any interesting hands that you can think of that you played, or
I have hands from online that I basically, whenever I play an interesting hand online, I'll like save it in my HUD as something to like discuss on a podcast. Mm-hmm. But I also have notes on pretty much every hand I played live this summer. But just looking through them, I don't really have a way to tell which one might be interesting.
Okay. All right.
So if you want to.
I've got one if you.
Well, okay, so we can do that, but also I just want to give you an option. Like, if you want me to look through the live ones and try to find an interesting live one, or I can just pull up an online one from my holder manager.
Yeah, maybe if you could find a live one, and then I'll talk this live one here.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay. All right. Okay, you want me to go first?
Yep.
Okay. All right, so this hand is in the this is in the 1K deep stack. It's late on day one. We've been doing pretty well, and we got 80 big blinds, and we're in UTG plus one, and we have ace king off suit, and we raise it to, the blinds were 500, 1K. We raise it to 3,200. And it, the guy to my immediate left, UTG two, he calls 3,200. He's a recreational player. I think he's always three betting there with like aces, kings, queens. He's probably flatting with ace queen, probably calling or three betting with ace king, and then flatting with a lot of like small pairs and stuff like that. Yeah, so we make it 3.2. He calls. The very next guy, this guy is, if he's not a pro, he's very, he's competent.
Gotcha.
And he's a younger guy, probably late 20s, early 30s. Just been playing real smart, tight, and that's about it. I nothing stands out in my head that I saw him like, wow, I wouldn't have done that, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
He three bets, and I made it 3,200. He made it 11,000. Folds all the way around through the blinds and back on us. I have 80 big blinds, UTG2. The guy to my left, he's got about 60 or 70 big blinds. And then the three better, UTG3, he's got me just covered. He's probably got like 90K. So what are you thinking here with ace king offsuit when we opened a 3.2, one call, a three bet, and then it's back on us?
How many bigs did we start the hand with?
We started with 80, and the three better has 90. So we're effectively playing 80 against him, and then the guy to our left, he has 60 or 70 big blinds.
The three better is in what position?
UTG3. So under the gun folded, we raised UTG1, UTG2 called, and then UTG3, three bet.
I think you have to call here.
Okay. And what's your...
Because of the positions, unless this guy is like known as an aggressive three better, his range is going to be super strong right here.
Yeah.
And so you could like four bet, and then like if he jams, you probably should fold, but you probably won't. So if you're going to be sick to your stomach and face a five bet shove, then you probably should just flat in the spot. Cause it's not like this is like a standard cut off open button flats and then small bond squeeze spot.
Yeah.
This is like all happened in the EP, 80 bigs deep, effective. Like, what does this guy look like? I don't know if you said that or not.
He's late 20s, early 30s, been playing competent. I'd never seen him like, we've been playing all day. This is like hour 9 or 10. And I hadn't seen him get out of line or see anything that was like, oh, wow, I need to three bet him more or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is kind of a special case where I don't think you can just get in ace king pre. You probably can, I guess it's fine. Like it's probably like slightly losing or break even. But this deep, I'm more willing to like just flat and play post. If you give me like 50 bigs to here, I might just go ahead and get it in.
Yeah, when this happened, I was running through Alexander Fitzgerald's class that I took and his shove charts and not necessarily shove charts, but like three betting, four betting, five betting charts. And he recommends getting ace king off and a queens plus, basically an ace king suited in 45 bigs or less. And I remember him saying in the video, he's like, you know, the ace king off is just to kind of like balance your range. You can almost kind of let it go or not, you know, it's just kind of to, since you have an ace and a king, you're blocking aces and kings. And, you know, he went through that speech and then it was kind of like a take it or leave it one, you know? And when I was like, what would you range this three better on? Like, what would you say he has here? Like, tens plus ace queen suited or
not even tens?
Okay.
I'm not even sure about jacks, like queens plus, and I don't even know, like he may not, like there's some people who won't three bet ace king here. Now this is a younger guy, so I'll give him ace king. I'm gonna say So if I'm being generous, I'm going to say like Jax plus Ace King. But I can also see this being like Queens plus.
Ace King suited or something, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That was my thought. And I thought to myself, I'm like, when he three bet, my first thought was, oh, here we go. This is a four bet. And then I started looking at the stacks. I'm like, he just made it 11 bigs. I have 80 behind. So for me to three bet here, I got to make it, what, 30? And that's not even 3X his bet. I mean, if I really want to stick to the program, I got to make it 33K plus. And now I've just put in, you know, almost half my stack. And what do I do when he shoves? Like, am I ever good there, you know?
Yeah.
And so maybe this is pretty nitty. It could have been because, you know, we're on hour 10 and we got to go another hour and then we bag and I'm looking down at 77 bigs, which used to be 80. And I'm like, is this really a spot that I want to take here? Like I did think of flatting, but what kind of steered me away from that was that his range is so damn strong and I'm going to be out of position for the rest of the hand. I think the guy to my left is probably, he could call along if I call, but I think the majority of the time he's just folding there. I think he did not look like he had a very strong range at all when he called my bet. It was kind of like oh, Jack 10 suited kind of thing, you know, one something like that.
Yeah, so if this guy's just in there like splashing around and we're not so worried about him, then I kind of look at his money as almost like dead money,
yeah.
And so us and the other guy are basically fighting for his dead money, and that actually makes me want to like flat, because there's something to fight for. I might be more likely to just fold if there wasn't anything to fight for here.
Okay,
like for example, say if you open and the guy nobody else, you open, everybody else folds, and then this guy like three bets to like half his stack. You probably just fold Ace King without even, you know, worried about it.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of looking at it now like, okay, there's something in there to fight for. But yeah, you're right. You're going to be out of position. If I knew more about the guy, where like, I want to know, is this guy going to bet three times on a King high flop if he also has Ace King? Some people might bet twice and then check back river against. If I feel like the guy's going to check at any point post-flop with a hand that if he's not going to value bet one pair three times, then I'm more likely to call. But if this is the type that could have, like, say, I don't know, I guess Ace-King. Ace-King is the thing we're worried about. If he has Ace-King and we get a king high board, if he's gonna bet like twice and shove river or whatever, then I'd rather just fold now because I can't call that shove.
Yeah.
So it really depends on how aggressive this guy is. If it's like, if he's passive to where I think he's gonna slow down at some point, I call. If he's aggressive where I feel like he's gonna be over aggressive and I can just bluff catch at some point, I call. But if he's somewhere in the middle, if I'm unsure, I can get on board with a fold here. This is a spot where Alex will say fold and then never tell anybody you folded.
Yeah, and never talk about it on a podcast.
yeah. And that often happens with Ace King and also Jacks or maybe Queens. Those are the type of hands that you can kind of find a fold with and just never tell anybody.
Yeah. Make sure that you do not lazily flip them over by accident when you're folding. Just make sure you slide them across the table into the muck.
Yeah, the worst thing you could do is like fold them face up proudly.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because that's what a lot of people will do.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a tough spot for me. And I thought, I don't know. I guess maybe I got too into like we're deep in the event. I got 77 bigs right now. Do I really want to gamble right here with Ace King? And like when he flips over kings, like, well, what the hell did you think he had? You know, kind of thing. And yeah. I Yeah, so I end up laying it down. The guy to my left lays it down. He throws his hand away, and an hour later when the tournament ended, we had a friendly dynamic going, you know, so I asked him, and I said, what did you have that hand that you 3-bet to 11K? And he didn't pause or anything. He knew exactly what I was talking about, and he said, I had ace-king. I was like, wow. Okay. All right. Nice play, sir. I don't know. I asked Chris Kusha about that on the break right after that happened. And he said, well, you could call. And I'm like, and you're playing ace king out of position to, a guy that's competent. And he's all, yeah. He's like, well, I don't really like folding, and I don't like four betting because you're committed to calling a shove. I'm like, okay. Then I asked another guy, Mike Pearson. I don't know if you know him or not, but he's a pro.
Yeah, I actually stayed with him for a while this summer.
Okay, yeah, you know exactly. And I asked him, and he said the same thing. He said, you know, you could call there, and then I put the same argument, and he's like, yeah, but sometimes he has ace king. And I'm all, ironically, yeah. That's what he had.
he actually has ace king a lot here, even though we block it. If you think about it, we have two, so there's nine combos of ace king. There's three combos each of aces and kings, and six combos of queens. So if we give him like queens plus ace king,
yeah,
he's got nine ace kings, 12 of the pairs, so 9 and 21 is 3 and 7. So like 42% of his range here is going to be ace king. And if you can kind of like if you're confident in how he would play those on different board types, then you can continue. It's almost like this is a this would be a GTO call, I think, or at least like Poker Snow is never folding here. It's either going to like 4-bet or call, and it's probably like close to split on what it wants to do, which of those two options it wants to take. But that's because it has to protect its calling range against an aggressive person who's going to have some bluffs in this spot. If we don't think this guy has bluffs in this spot, then we can probably get away with folding ace king here. Like, for example, I bet you a good player or a GTO opponent probably does this with ace five suited sometimes. And, yeah. And this guy probably isn't doing that.
Yeah, okay. If he has exactly queens plus an ace king, I just ran it right now against our ace king off, and we're 40-60. So we're 40%, he's 60, but that's in a vacuum if it all goes in.
Yeah. And also remember, it's not going to be that big of a difference, but it helps if we consider this other guy's chips as dead money. Like, we don't need to have 50-50 equity here.
True.
So maybe we need like 45% equity. So in that case, you know, it's still a fold if we had to get it all in here. But that's why you kind of have to, either this guy needs to have some passivity post-flop to where he's not going to always value bet top pair, top kicker, and he's not always going to continue bluffing with it on spots where you both miss. Mm-hmm. Or you need to be able to turn your hand into a bluff at some point post-flop, where most of us aren't really capable of that. Like, yeah. For example, he 3-bets, you call, and say the flop comes like Jack 10-9, mm-hmm. all of a suit that maybe like the suit of your ace. I mean, not all, but like two of them. So like, what's your ace? A spade or?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I know it was offsuit.
So let's say you have the ace of spade.
Okay.
And the flop is like Jack 10 deuce or Jack 10 9 with two spades.
Yeah.
You have to be able to turn your hand into a bluff here. Like, maybe because like you can check raise this board, you got a lot of equity. And your range for flatting hits that board a lot harder than his range for three betting, because you could conceivably have like some Jack 10 suiteds, maybe even like pocket nines that this guy may not three bet with, but you would raise call with. So that's when like range advantage, like if you get a board where you have the range advantage, you have to be willing to turn your hand into a bluff.
Yeah.
And if you are able to do that, then the EV of flatting is higher for you. But if you feel like that is not in your game yet, then it might be better to just not go down that road, because it gets murky once you start playing that way.
That is a great point. I did not think of that. If I flat here, my range is relatively wide compared to his, but his is still queens plus ace king.
Yeah, his range is wide, and not only is it wide, it's kind of like
face up. Oh, my range is wide.
I'm sorry, yeah. His range is strong, but it's kind of like strong and narrow. So yeah. it's kind of face up. And a lot of his range is going to be one pair at best on a lot of runouts. And so when the board comes kind of coordinated, you have to be willing to turn your hand into a bluff and put a lot of pressure on his one pair hands in his range, because that's going to be the majority of his range. And most of us aren't capable of that. In fact, I had a similar hand against Phil Locke in one of the online events this summer, where I kind of tried to protect myself from him because I thought he was capable of kind of putting the squeezes on me when I was in a case. Well, when I was in a spot where I had a strong range that was kind of like one pair at best, because I three bet. And so like anytime you three bet and your three betting range doesn't have a robust groupings, a grouping of hands where you have board coverage on a lot of runouts, you're gonna run into this problem. So yeah, I think good players flat in these spots and then kind of take advantage of that when they get the right board for it. But I'm not really on that level yet, so I'm okay with folding.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah, that was a tough one for me, especially when he told me he had ace king. I'm like, oh, maybe I could have blown him off pre-flop. Maybe I could fucking call. Like you said, that was a tough one. But I made day two and then eventually day three, so whatever. But yeah. Who knows? Maybe I could have gotten an extra 15 or 20 bigs there. That was an interesting one. But did you find a live one?
I didn't find a live one, but I did find one from a bracelet event that I played on WSOP.com.
Oh, okay.
And this is actually the same event, the same table where I played against Phil Locke. And the hand, I played a really interesting hand against him where I tried to use GTO to protect myself. Mm-hmm. I discussed that one on another podcast, so I won't repeat that one here, but I do have another one that's kind of interesting. So we're at the 200, 400 level.
Okay.
And I have 18,000. We are 3, 6, 8 handed. Oh, by the way, this is the $400 bracelet event that they had at the beginning of June.
Okay.
So I'm in UTG 2 with 45 bigs with ace of spades, ace of diamonds.
That's a pretty good starting hand.
Yep, pretty good. So I'm in raise. This is something that I've been doing per Ryan LaPlante's coaching. So min raise is normal for me here. I'm not doing that just because I have aces or anything like that.
Okay.
Button calls. Now the button has me covered. He has about 25K. And I don't know anything about him. I'm looking at the replay right now, and I don't have any kind of player tag on him.
Okay.
So
polls.
Yep.
Okay.
And now we're heads up. Everybody else polls.
Okay. So effective stacks are 45 big blinds, 18K, 1600 plus. Do you remember, were antes in play yet? Or was it just
there was 450 in the middle for antes.
450. Okay.
So right now there's 2650 in the middle.
2650 in the pot. Okay.
Okay.
650. And you're out of position. Okay.
Yep. So the flop is Jack of Hearts, Six of Spades, and Four of Hearts. And I do not have a heart.
Okay. You got a spade and a diamond. Pocket aces. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. It's on us. 2650. He just calls on the button. We could get value from a lot of jacks. Any two hearts. He didn't three bet you, so I'm going to assume that he doesn't have queens plus. Probably doesn't have jacks, but there's still a lot of jacks out there as far as like ace, jack, king, jack, queen, jack, jack 10, jack 9 suited. Probably not jack 8 suited. Yeah, I'm throwing out a value bet. No, 2650, I don't know, less than half, maybe 1100, something like that.
Okay. With my range here, I'm not going to do a whole lot of betting.
Okay.
Being out of position, I should have the range advantage is kind of interesting on this board. We can both have all the sets. Honestly, I can have a number of two pairs here that he probably wouldn't expect. With like 6-4 suited, I would open. Honestly, maybe even like Jack 4, Jack 6 suited, just because of how Ryan has been playing.
Wait, you would open that UTG too?
Yeah.
Wow.
What do we said? This started 45 bigs deep. Mm-hmm. No, I wouldn't do it off this stack size. 100 bigs, yes. That's just like some stuff Ryan's been working with me on.
Okay.
But those things he probably wouldn't put in my range, but I don't think he should have those in his range. Trying to think who has the most flush draws here. He probably has the most flush draws.
Probably him.
Yeah, there shouldn't be a whole bunch of straight draws. So it's tough to say who. If we're going to call like one pair, the nuts here, then I definitely have the nut advantage because he can't have aces or kings, maybe not even queens.
Mm-hmm.
But range advantage feels close, but I think I probably have the range advantage also. So I think I do like a bet on this board. And I chose a smaller sizing. This is something that I've been working on and I'm not 100% confident in yet. I know on a lot of boards, we should be betting smaller than was common like a year ago. Usually it's going to be around quarter pot to third pot on a lot of boards. And I'm not 100% sure which board should be that. So I just bet 800 here. And this is something that I'll kind of do pretty often is just bet around third pot on a lot of boards. And not 100% sure why, but that's what I'm doing right now.
Okay.
So I bet 800 here. And he calls.
No one calls 800.
And then now the turn.
4250 in the middle.
Yep, 4250 in the middle.
Okay.
And the turn is the Jack of Hearts. I'm sorry, the King of Hearts.
King of Hearts. Okay.
So the flush draw came in.
Okay, so we got Ace of Spades, Ace of Diamonds. The flop was Jack of Hearts, Six of Spades, Four of Hearts, and now the turn is the King of Hearts. And we're first to act with 4250 in the middle.
Yeah.
I mean, if we check here, it looks like we just have one pair, or we, is there like a check call here? I don't know if he had something like, I mean, when he just calls there and he doesn't raise, okay, we'll say he has all sets. He's got heart draws. He's got a jack. He's probably calling there on that flop with like tens, nines, eights, and sevens, right?
Mm-hmm.
Probably folding pocket fives, pocket threes, and pocket deuces. Yeah, I'm gonna throw out another bet just to get value from things like if he has pocket tens with the ten of hearts, all jacks. If he's got like jack ten, queen jack with maybe one heart, or even just those naked, he'll probably call. I would throw out another bet.
Yeah, I think he has a lot of type of hands, like a lot of those type of hands in his range.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, we're losing to King Jack, but whatever. Monsters under the bed. Yeah, I'm throwing a value bet out.
Okay. What's us?
Into 4250. $1,500, $1,500 to $1,700, something like that. I want to charge the single hearts, you know.
Yeah, I do too, but I don't think that price does it. They almost have the right price. There's 250 in the middle.
Yeah, 4250 plus 15. Yeah, that would be giving him about 25%. Huh? Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe we got to go bigger. Maybe we got to do like 2K, 21.
I wouldn't double that.
Wow. You bet pot?
I bet pot.
Okay.
And so
I like it.
And this is another thing that, you know, I'm kind of learning as I go, but I do know in a lot of situations, the GTO play is to bet small on the flop and big on the turn. And so just as a blanket statement, I know that's true, but the nuances, I need more work on the nuances and the reasoning behind it. Now I can kind of say the reasoning here is that, like you said, the type of hands that we're trying to get value from are kind of like inelastic to the size because they have like so much equity, or in their mind perceived equity. Like if this guy has like, you know, ace jack with the ace of hearts, he's not folding to this. True. He's got to draw to the nuts. I could just be trying to rep the king as a bluff. And people don't like to fold when they have outs.
Yeah.
And so I don't see this guy folding any of those type of hands that we mentioned. And the hands that will fold to this bet, like I can't think of a lot of hands that will fold to pot that wouldn't fold to like two thirds. And I feel like we definitely need to bet at least two thirds pot here.
Okay.
And this is another thing. Now this one is definitely not rooted in theory at all, but on these boards where like a draw comes in, I rarely bet pot or less because I know this guy may want to try to rep this draw. And so if I show weakness, I think he can maybe like raise the bet. Like if I bet like third pot here, I think it's going to get raised a decent amount of the time because it doesn't look like I have a flush and he still has all the flushes in his range. So what I'll do is bet like at least 55, 60%, like something over half pot, just to kind of like, I think those bets look more serious and people are less likely to raise them as a bluff. Like for example, if I bet pot or even like two thirds pot here and I get raised, I'm like happily folding this. But if I bet like one third pot and I get raised, I'm going to be suspicious.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that one is definitely not solid theory wise at all, but it's kind of like a mental game trick I use to like prevent myself from like thinking that I induced a raise. Like I want to bet an amount that I'm happy to fold if that bet gets raised.
Yeah.
Okay. But primarily, I feel like he still has a lot of hands in his range that has some showdown equity combined with draw equity that can call a big bet here. So I'm not bluffing here. I'm still value betting. I'm just targeting a stronger – I just have stronger value targets so I can choose a bigger sizing.
Okay. I like that. That's good. So when this show comes out, I'm going to rewind that about 3 times and listen to it again.
Yeah, and then run it by somebody who knows what the hell they're talking about. Because I'm just making this shit up as I go. Like I said.
Oh, this is gold, Carlos. Don't sell yourself.
At least 70% of what I've said in the last, 10 to 15 minutes is my fish logic. And then the other, 30 to 35% might be rooted in theory.
It might be backed by Andrew and Ryan.
Yes, and Poker Snowy.
Yeah.
So I bet pot here, and the guy calls again.
How quickly did he call? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Okay. All right. So we got 12,750 in the pot, which is about what we have behind. So we got a pot size bet left behind. We've got ace of spades, ace of diamonds. The board was jack of hearts, six of spades, four of hearts. The turn was the king of hearts. We do not have a heart. Villain calls. What's the river?
The river is the lovely jack of clubs.
Okay. So, I guess when he calls the turn there, we can range him on, like you said, a big heart, a jack, a king. I guess that's... And then a lot of heart draws. And probably a lot of jacks, too. I guess it's good that the jack came out because then it's less likely that it'll have one. Shit. Okay, if we shove here, we're getting snapped by a jack. Do we get called by, king-queen with the king or with the queen of hearts?
That's a good question. I can kind of see fish calling because they have top pair. Mm-hmm. And I can kind of see good players calling because they block some flush draws since they have a queen of hearts. They block queen jack. And they also block king queen as far as I don't even know if they would expect me to bet that one though. But basically they block some of my value range, so I can kind of see both bad players and good players possibly finding a call with their hand.
Yeah. That's only a few combos though. Oh man, if we just check here, we're just basically announcing that we have the one pair, and as Alex Fitzgerald would say, players play pretty well when they know what you have. God damn, this is a tricky spot.
Yeah. So to figure it out, I think you have to go back to the turn. One little trick you can use is when you're trying to range people, go back to the spot, the most significant spot in the hand. And the most significant spot in this hand was the pot size turn bet.
Yeah.
So you gotta, that's the best place to range them at. So for example, does he still have, so we know he doesn't have, so this is the question we have to ask ourselves is if he folds a jack to that pot size bet on the turn. We definitely do not think he folds the ones that have a heart kicker.
True.
But if he doesn't have a heart kicker, does he call? I think so with ace jack. Obviously, he calls with king jack, and honestly, he may just call with king jack. like I'll say sometimes people will raise on the turn with two pair better, but I think that's less likely when A, there's a flush draw out there, and B, they're facing a pot size bet.
Pot size bet, yeah.
Yeah, so I think you can still have ace jack, king jack, queen jack. Because I don't know this guy, I'll probably give him that also, because people tend to like make calling mistakes. People don't generally hero fold as much as they should. And I'll probably start looking at like jack 10, maybe like jack 9 suited that don't contain flush draw. I can kind of see him folding. Like if he has like jack 10 of spades here, I can kind of see him letting that go on the turn facing a pot size bet. But that's a lot of jacks.
Yeah.
So we listed a lot of jacks. The other thing that makes a lot of sense is flush draws. I think a lot of people will definitely call preflop with hearts. And they're obviously not folding hearts to the C bet. Some people will raise, but I think a lot of people will just call. And then on the turn, if he has a flush that's not like the nut flush, even like A, if he has the nut flush, he may just call because he has the nuts. Like, why not let me bluff it all?
Yep.
And if he has a weaker flush draw, he may just call because he doesn't have the nuts.
Because he's not there yet.
Yeah. So I think all the flushes are still in his range. A whole lot of jacks. And like you said, the hands that we're getting value from, we're basically targeting a king. But I don't even know if he gets here with ace, king of spades. So ace kings that don't contain the ace of hearts, I don't think he gets here with those. A lot of them three bet pre. And a lot of them just fold to the C bet. Same thing with the king queens. We talked about those. King jack, I think, is still there. That beats us. King 10.
So I was thinking that exact one, king 10. I'm like, does he ever get to the turn with king 10? Well, maybe with 800. And then when he calls, like.
Yeah, I think like maybe king 10 of clubs. I mean, of spades with backdoor flush draw and like. It kind of wraps around the jack and, you know, he's facing a small bet size. Some people will float with those type of hands, but definitely if he has like king 10 of king 10 off with the
10 of hearts,
I think he will, what he call a pot size bet with that. Yeah. People don't like to fold top pair with a flush draw, even if it's not a great flush draw. So I think he has a few kings we can target. Question is, will those even call a shove at this point? I think those hands, people don't like to fold top pair, but on a paired flush draw board, I think they can be convinced to fold top pair.
Yeah.
So I don't think we have a lot we can target here. When we look at the range of hands that beat us versus the range that we beat, I think we're outnumbered. Probably close to 2-1.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's very specific king hands. And yeah. Is he ever calling with pocket tens or nines here? I don't think so.
Yeah, I think those. See, that's why I say go back to the significant street, because a pot size bet on the turn, I think that gets rid of tens and nines right there.
Yeah, tens, nines, eights, and sevens, I think are gone.
Had I bet third pot on the turn, then yeah, those hands might still be around. But that big bet kind of like, squeezes the ranges through a funnel really quick.
Yeah, it washes them out. Yeah.
So yeah. I think this river card sucks for us, and we're pretty screwed here a lot of the times.
This might be an interesting spot into 12K. You do something like you bet, 2K, and you bet like five big blinds, and you get a call from the king, and then everything else raises you. Or maybe like a weak jack is like, no, a weak jack would raise there, right?
See, this is what's so tricky about those small bets. It's like, I don't know if, I think that looks so weak that No, that doesn't really apply here. Never mind. I guess my question would be, if we check to this guy, does he bet a king? I don't think so. I think a king checks back here.
I think so.
I don't think he has a ton of hands in his range to bluff with. Oh, I guess that's what I was getting at. If he does have some potential bluffs in his range, he may choose to attack a super weak, like obvious blocking bet with those type of hands. And I'm thinking a hand like maybe ace queen with the ace of hearts.
I was just about to say the same thing.
Yeah. And so if we bet, especially if we bet small, does that hand just call or does it raise? Like, does that hand think it has showdown value facing a bet? I don't know. But I think a lot of the benefits to that small bet size, we kind of get by just checking. Okay. I don't think he he may just try to showdown ace queen if he goes check check. I think ace queen might be good sometimes. Or maybe he thinks we're checking with the intention of calling a bet, so he's less likely to bluff. I don't know. The river decision is kind of tricky to me. I know we can't value bet big because we don't have enough value targets.
True.
And so the choice is checking, just hoping it goes to showdown, or possibly calling a bet, or betting small ourselves and hoping that the guy doesn't read that as weakness and raise. So I can kind of see both being possibilities. In game, I decided to check.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Maybe 2K is a little too small. Maybe you got to make it 3 or something and then leave yourself 9K behind. And
this is what I was saying earlier about, like, I wish I had enough chip to bet like 7K here.
Yeah.
If I had enough chips to bet 7K and he raised, I would happily fold.
Yeah.
But if I bet 2K and he raises, I might get suspicious.
Yeah, then you're like, okay, well, I just wasted 2K. Now I got to call another
seven. Yeah, I definitely think that way sometimes. I've gotten screwed in the past that way. So I checked, and he bet 4,200 into 12,750. So he bet basically third pot.
Yeah. I literally just threw the pen down.
yeah. It's fun and abrasive of it.
Yeah, it's like 10 bigs on the river. Like, are we ever good here? Like, would a king bet that? I don't think so. I think you're right. I think a king is checking back.
And the kings that would bet that aren't even in the range. Like, ace king could bet this, but I don't think ace king gets here in this fashion.
No, I think you would have heard from him pre-flop.
Right. And I don't think king 10 bets. So maybe king queen is the only king that could possibly do this, but even that's a stretch in my opinion.
It's that and like with the ace of hearts, like ace queen and ace 10, is he really flatting ace 10 off suit there pre-flop?
And yeah, I mean, I know some people do for sure,
but I think that's pretty like unlikely, right? I mean, yeah, that'd be a better 3-better a fold, right?
And right. Yeah, but people definitely make mistakes.
Okay.
And the question is, what does he do with a hand on the turn facing the pot size bet?
Yeah.
Again, if he has the heart with it, he may float again. But that one would be pretty bad.
Yeah.
When all he has is a gutter to go with his flush draw. But again, people make mistakes. So I got to give it. So I'll wait that one. So I can give him like maybe he has like ace 10 with the ace of hearts 25% of the time.
Yeah.
And honestly, I try to have like consistent reads in that someone who's so horribly passive that there's such a station that they're calling with their hand pre and calling a pot-sized bet on a turn with it. That person, that player type doesn't all of a sudden get aggressive and turn into a bluff on the river, especially not for this sizing.
That's a good point. Yeah. It looks super value-y.
Yeah. Yeah. And he has a lot of value hands in his range. So yeah. when the bet looks value-y and he has a lot of perceived value, then I think we have to be careful about bluff catching with hands that aren't necessarily great for bluff catching. Like, yeah. For example, if I somehow had king, queen with a heart or ace, king with a heart, I think that would make a much better call here than pocket aces. Because now we're blocking.
Because you're blocking it.
Yeah. And at this point, I mean, it's either those two hands beat the same bluffs. Like, we're only trying to – like, if we call here, we're bluff catching.
Yeah.
So we're only trying to beat hands that were bluff, which would be hands that are worse than one pair. So if he's not, quote-unquote, turning king-queen into a bluff, then it doesn't matter if we call with king-queen or aces. They both beat the same range. So when that's the case, you'd rather call with the one that blocks the value range, the two-pair better combos in the opponent's range.
Yeah.
So I decided to fold here.
Yeah, after talking through this, I think that's the move.
Yeah. And unfortunately, because it's WSOP.com as opposed to Bovada.
We have no idea what he had.
We'll never know what he had. I think it was an interesting hand. A lot of unorthodox decisions that I made in the hand that I'm not 100% sure are correct. This is a hand that I need to kind of like run through some software and run by some fellow players. But yeah, I think it's a pretty good one for discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. That was interesting. So you're doing min raise with everything, your whole range.
Yes. And Okay. Basically what Ryan says about that is, if people aren't three betting you and they're making like pretty bad mistakes post flop, then the small sizing is going to be more profitable in the long run because people stick around with some garbage hands that turn into slightly stronger garbage hands and they can't find folds with them in certain spots. And also, if you do get three bet, usually people three bet too small, so you can kind of continue with a bigger percentage of your opening range. So like, for example, let's say if I had like 6-5 suited and I raised to like 3x and I get three bet, the effective stacks are going to be so, or the implied odds are going to be so small that I just have to fold the hand. Whereas if I min raise and I get three bet, there's some chance I can call with a hand if people do this like 2.5, 3-bet size that's too small. So basically, if you feel like you're not getting 3-bet a lot and you have a skill edge on the table, you want to keep the SPR as high as possible.
Okay.
That way you have more room to like, A, outplay people post-flop if you need to kind of like turn your hand into a bluff, and B, have more implied odds available if you happen to hit like flush over flush or two pair over two pair when they're getting in there with a weaker range, because they kind of have to when you go small.
Yeah. Now this is interesting because I do a little bit more than 3x and I have been for a while. And it's very often that I go to the flop heads up. Do you feel like you're getting flatted like by two or three players every time or?
Very often. Yes.
Okay. See, that's the part that's tough for me is I would much rather just play against one guy than, you know, three people.
Right. So that's the two schools of thought that Alex and Ryan present is like Alex always talk about the bigger size, get a heads up with the big blind, and you know, you'd rather play a big pot against one player. But I think Ryan's philosophy is he doesn't mind playing multi-way pots against multiple players, because when you smash it and they smash it slightly worse, you're going to get like their entire stack. Like, like for example, we talked about the button calling with a hand like ace 10 off. Mm-hmm. Ryan doesn't want that guy to fold that hand.
Yeah. So
he wants to use the size and that kind of gets that guy trapped in their post spot with that hand. But if you play this way, like you said, you're going to be involved in a lot of tricky spots and multi-way pots from out of position very often. And so you got to be able to navigate those spots well. Otherwise, you will kind of like, if you're making the same mistakes post-flop that your opponents are making, then you don't gain any edge by playing this way. But if you can make better decisions in those tricky spots than they can, then you make more money than you do by like forcing them to fold their garbage pre-flop.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of spots where like I'll open from the cutoff or something with, 9-7 of hearts. And then the big blind kind of reaches for chips to call and he's all, wait, how much is it?
Yeah.
3,200? Oh. Huh. And then he looks at his hand and you're like, oh, perfect. He's folding.
Yeah. <You know? laughs> Yeah.
So. But it's that extra sizing that drives him to do that, you know?
Right. And so the difference, so that's going to be the difference. What was I saying? I lost my train of thought there.
Like you're going to get those guys with those crappy hands out instead of calling with them.
Yeah.
But I am opening kind of wide too. I'm opening half a hand, you know?
Yeah.
Seven of clubs isn't a great hand. I really don't want action, but if I do get it, I have something that can
right.
at least so, get something.
So that's definitely the way to differentiate between these two styles. Like very often, Ryan wants action. Like even okay. with bad hands, he wants action. He wants to play post flop because he thinks he has a bigger edge post flop, and the pots are bigger when you start talking about post flop action. Mm-hmm. And basically, you get more decision points, and he expects to be able to make better decisions at those points than his opponent. I think that's what he would say about why he doesn't, you know, raise bigger and kind of like you said, give them an easy decision with a hand like ace 10 offsuit. It's just an easy fold, which yeah. is good for you because you pick up the pot more often. But if you know how to navigate through this gauntlet that you create for yourself when you min raise, then it can be more profitable. But you kind of need Ryan LaPlante post-flop skill level to be able to do it. And I'm trying to get there. I'm not there yet. Clearly, as we can see, I'm sure a lot of stuff I said on the podcast today isn't correct. But, you know, the more I learn from him and play around with these GTO pieces of software, I think I can navigate those murky spots a little bit better than I currently can.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, that's basically how you make money from the game, is you try to create as many decision points as possible. And if your opponents are making decisions worse than you, then you're going to make more money. It sounds like that's what Ryan's doing with the smaller sizing, is he's purposely creating those inflection or decision points along the way. You know, in a tournament, let's just say an average tournament, maybe Ryan makes 800 decisions and I make 350.
That's exactly what Ryan would say. Yes.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So this is the hard part for us as poker students. It's like both of these schools of thought make sense. And I think they're both correct. They both have pros and cons. And we just have to learn how to play both of them correctly.
Yeah.
And B, know when to employ which of the two strategies. At any given time.
Yeah, maybe that's right. There was a lot of spots, especially in those dailies where the players are just so bad. When you have two pros on your left, maybe it's time to use 3.2 sizing. And when you have nothing but amateurs on your left, maybe the min raise is a little bit better.
Yeah. That actually makes sense to me. In fact, yeah, that kind of that's 100% true. And Ryan plays that way. Like the reason he says to Minray is here because it's a soft table and you're not going to get three bet a lot. Now, if you got pros on you that are three betting you all the time, then yeah, you do have to raise bigger to kind of discourage that. And so at some point, as your table gets tougher, you're going to kind of like revert back to GTO by using the bigger sizings. But when you feel like your opponents have some identifiable leaks and you know how to exploit those, then you kind of want to like, you know, make the first move that kind of set them up for like the third and fourth move that results in them losing their whole stack. But yeah, you can't do that when you have good players behind.
Yeah. Yeah. Who is going to three bet me and what can I do to prevent that? That should be your question every time you open.
Yes. And if the answer is nobody three bet you, then A, open smaller, and B, open more often.
Yeah.
That's what Ryan was saying.
I like that.
Hence Jack four suited that I was talking about earlier.
Yeah. Okay. I like that a lot. This is a good one, Carlos. I feel like this is in probably the top 7 or 8% of our podcast as far as like content of maybe I'm just tooting my own horn and Ryan and Alex will listen to this and be like, oh my God, these guys are fucked up. But
I think there's a 50-50 chance that happens.
I feel like we kind of held our own here.
Yeah. We're getting there, man. We're getting there. I'll put it this way. I'm still a proud card-carrying mediocre poker player, but I do know I'm a lot better this year than I was this time last year.
Yeah, for sure. Yes, me too.
Yep.
Yeah. Right on, man. Well, thank you for coming on the show. We'll throw a link in the show notes for your episode on satellites. Go ahead and shoot me that over and I'll put it in. If you guys want to get coaching from Carlos, you can go to headsuppoker.poker, click on the circle of trust, and he's right there. He's got all his Twitter links and Facebook and a link to his coaching, so you can get that there. If you want to get your free 7-minute tilt buster by Elliot Rowe, click on the link in the show notes. If you purchase one of Elliot's MP3s, use the code HUPOKER. And same for Alexander Fitzgerald, Master Tournament Poker in one class. A lot of these over 3x sizing and 3-bets and all that I'm talking about here on the show, I got from that program, and the first hour is free. So you can check that out by clicking on the link in the show notes or go to headsuppoker.poker and it's right up in the banner. Thank you for tuning in. And here is your weekly motivational speech.
Our circumstances, your current surroundings, never have to dictate who you are. You're not what your surroundings are. You are what you do. And this is the fact of the matter. Normal, regular people just like you and me can do extraordinary things. And it's not about the glitz and the glamour and the shine. It's not about what we have. It's about our heart, man. It's about people, you and me, understanding that we are fully capable. We have the full potential to achieve and become anything that anybody else is. And the only person that's gonna stop us, and the only person that's gonna rob us, is when we look in the mirror and we compromise us. Too often we as young men and young women, and I was so guilty of this, we only care about the now, and woo-woo this and woo-woo that, and what feels good here and what feels good now, and we will compromise who we are because we want the acceptance of the people around us. And that's just real, man. I don't pursue profits. I pursue my purpose. As you go on to the next chapter, don't pursue profits. Pursue purpose. Don't pursue the profits of where can you gain things in life. Pursue your passions and your purpose. Because what happens is, a lot of times we go on to college or we go on to the next chapter and we're only seeking gains. We're only trying to find out what we can get. Where can we find profits in our lives? You need to take time to figure out your why. You need to take time to figure out what you're passionate about. Because if you pursue your passion, I promise, passion and purpose will always produce gains and profits socially, emotionally, and financially, man. You can show me your friends and I can tell you who you are. Who you surround yourself with is going to affect you. Like it, love it, or leave it. If you're surrounding yourself with people who are not about the right, who aren't trying to pursue dreams and goals and the same aspirations and the same motivations and dedications and determinations as you, you will be affected. Who you surround yourself with matters. It's the compromise that I care about. We don't ever have to compromise ourselves. I promise you, from the front, the back, the left, to the right, every single one of you in here, man, you were born to leave your fingerprints on history. You can achieve and become absolutely anything. I mean, teachers and doctors and actors and athletes and entertainers and musicians and radiologists and cardiologists and cosmetologists, social workers. I'm telling you, anything that you want. And not a teacher, a counselor, a principal, nobody can stop you. I know your circumstances aren't the best. I know sometimes our home environment's not the best. But this is what I know. We're in control of our lives, and nobody can take it from you.